So I'm Tom Scott, and I'm with Kelly Corrigan, and Kelly and I just spent some time together in a variety of places around the country, but one in particular was at the Fox Lane Project.
Gray Fox Lane. In SoCal.
Yeah, the Gray Fox Lane Project in Malibu, California. And it was episode 3, which is about Gordon and Lulie Gund. It's the story of Gordon Gund's blindness and the relationship between two people and sort of the world that they create. And I found I mostly just listened, but I found the conversation there just so satisfying.
It was incredible. I mean, there was almost in the room. So, you know, the Gordon story is that they had two sons, and 2 weeks after his second son was born, the culmination of many years of his deteriorating sight happened, and he went blind. So it was sort of threatening and hovering, and his vision was getting, more and more impaired until, like, the lights went out. And then they had to decide, like, how were they going to live? And was he going to do the same job? And, you know, who was going to walk around with him all day? And how were they going to protect him from the household and the children and their toys at kind of rug level? And they made this incredible decision to partner together to try to cure the blindness that he had. And the group at Gray Fox Lane, the Gray Fox Lane Project, to me, as I recall it, the Gray Fox Lane Project was most interested in the impact of that partnership on their marriage. So, like, what can it be for a marriage to have a shared purpose other than raising children? And the people were kind of recognizing that, but for the blindness, surely Gordon would have gone on in his career. He was a venture capitalist, and Lulie was planning to be at home raising kids, and what a different marriage that would have been for them. And there was almost, I felt like, this palpable envy that because of this, you know, terrible loss, that they had an intimacy that isn't really as likely when you live a quote-unquote ordinary life.
Most of us tend to meet and have to absorb or step over or around challenges in our relationship. And it was really nice to see the way people reacted to Gordon and Lulie. And you know, there's that key moment where Lulie says effectively, hey, if you want to be super down about this and you feel like you got to go off yourself, okay, that's okay. But otherwise, you know, we're turning this around. We're going to make the very most of this situation, and we're going to go forward, which is all obviously what they ended up choosing. But the degree to which that was an act of love and a moment to bring them together. And you think about that. I remember when we were making the film, there was this, there was a bit of a controversy, like, should that be in the film or shouldn't that be in the film? And in the end, of course it should be in the film. It's the most human and loving sort of part of the whole story. And I really appreciated the way the room that night talked about
that. Oh, yeah. I mean, they picked that out right away as this turning point moment, and also this tremendous act of generosity on her part. That and just to acknowledge that maybe it is too much. Maybe that is too much to ask of a man to stay in the world after losing his sight, and that it's that hard, and that creating the space for that choice and saying that she wouldn't condemn him made possible his choice. You know, rather than it was an assignment that life had given him, she put it in terms of a choice that he could make, which is to stay in the world and try to do something about it. The other thing that it was making me think about is, you know, when you talk about strife, marital strife, inevitable, so often it's between the two partners. It's not an external source like that. And I think that what I was hearing in the Gray Fox Lane Project conversation that night was a little bit of how nice that is when it's something on the outside of your tiny circle of two rather than something that a tension between you. And, you know, I was really young. I was just a couple years into my marriage when I got cancer and started chemotherapy. And I remember thinking I really liked the way my husband handled it. And that year was generally like a great year in my life. And part of the greatness was thinking, all right, like this guy has really got the stuff, because you don't know until it starts raining what your person is going to do in bad weather. So, you know, it's nice to have that bad weather be some sort of outside force rather than what's much harder, which is like interpersonal conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the other part of that too, that I really, the part of the conversation we had at Gray Fox Lane was just talking about the concept generally of blindness.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, you know, Gordon once knew sight and now doesn't have it. And Yannick didn't know sight and later did have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, these are just phenomenally, you know, potent things to consider. And I guess more than anything else, what I really appreciated about it was when you have a conversation about it, it brings a kind of life to it that it's just otherwise very difficult to even consider, mm-hmm. you know? And I think it's sort of the nature of modern life that, you know, you don't get as much time sort of thinking on your own. And to the extent that you can sort of think collectively and consider collectively, that's a really interesting topic to think about, you know, the concept of living in darkness.
Yeah, and we talked about, which I just had never thought about before, and to your point, if I had watched the film alone and just toyed with the ideas in my own mind, I never would have crossed the threshold the way I did in that room that night. And in one particular way, I just had never thought about it before, which is what a terrible distraction all the visual noise is for us. And so people were talking about, like, once somebody introduced that idea of, like, it being a relief in some ways to see less. I mean, not to turn blindness into something that we are all craving. I mean, that's just stupid, but there was this acknowledgement that there's a lot of misunderstanding and misdirection that comes because of what we're seeing. So, you know, my daughter, when she went through puberty, she would have loved to have been known only for her ideas, only for the jokes that were coming out of her mouth, and not for her, you know, her zits and her greasy hair and her, you know, all these component pieces where you're half child, half woman, and you feel like you feel crazy in your own body, and you feel like all people are responding to is your container, and that you can't draw the attention, you can't draw the eye, so to speak, to what you're saying and what you're feeling and how you behave. And that was such an interesting conversation about what a gift it would be in some cases to only be known by your voice and yeah. not by your appearance.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's so I was at the Grand Canyon this past week. And, you know, one of the things about the Grand Canyon I will hopefully impact even one person on is that it is multiples more interesting than you would expect or than I expected. You know, its grandness is at least 10x grander than I ever would have guessed. I just had no idea. It also is arresting. You know, it is an arresting experience. You look out, and yeah, and you're just like, whoa, you are grabbed, and you are grabbed by something that is very different than so many parts of modern life. Just so many parts of modern life you sort of experience the opposite of that, and the gift of that. You know, at a time. And I'm relating it to that conversation we had that night, and I'm relating it to contemplating the life of Gordon Gund, where it was a similar kind of thing where I actually felt like I stepped outside of my my onness. You know, I feel like I'm so virtually connected to everything all the time, whether I'm connected or not. You know, I'm still tied to, I've got to do this thing, and then that thing's going to happen, and then I'm going to get one of these, and then I'm going to get four of those, and all this stuff's going to happen. Every once in a while, you have these moments where all of that goes away, like all of that sort of disappears. And I felt that in that room, and I felt that at the Grand Canyon, where I thought, whoa, I thought I knew things, and it turns out I just don't. And I thought I knew things about marriage and life and growth and success and expectations, and it turns out I just don't. And to have been given the gift of having some taste of it, because I do think in the end we're talking about really just some taste of it. I do think we can relate it to our own struggles, though. I mean, I think I can relate it to some tragedies I've experienced in my own life on some level. And there's something about, you know, the conversation that you had with the guns and their givingness in making a film. If you've never made a film, well, the one thing I will tell you is that you tend to ask a lot of people, some of whom are very private people, some of whom are more comfortable keeping their private matters to themselves. And the guns have given a lot to others in ways that they weren't historically so comfortable with. And it's been amazing to sort of watch those gifts play themselves out.
Yeah, you'll hear in the beginning of the conversation, we talk a little bit about resilience. And I was sort of digging around trying to figure out who Gordon Gund was before he went blind. And if maybe, as Yannick says in the film, the lights went out for a reason. In other words, that this that blindness befell someone who could really handle it and do great things with it. I'm not typically a person who believes things happen for a reason. So I was super pleased that the conversation at Grey Fox Lane Project went right there. People really debated what we mean when we say that and whether we are making reason out of something. Like we take a chaotic, irrational series of events and turn it into a story we can live with, and we are the meaning makers, or whether the meaning is there and we're more exploring and kind of digging for it. So that was a really fascinating part of the conversation that was triggered by illumination.
You know, so I was traveling with my son this last week, and one of my sons, my other son was away, so it was me and him. And at the moment, my son sees the world through Forrest Gump's eyes. So we would have these kinds of conversations where mama says life is like a box of chocolates, but Lieutenant Dan says, you know, it's all, what's the word? It's fatalistic. Like there's a plan and you're going to follow that specific plan. And, you know, and in the end, Forrest's conclusion, and my son's, therefore, his conclusion is that maybe it's both, you know, that maybe both of these things are happening at the same time. I so appreciate these moments in life where there's perfect imperfectness. Like there's just kind of no way to know, you know. I spent a lot of time looking into, I watched the Brief History of Time documentary when I was away. I started rereading the book while I was away because, you know, Stephen Hawking had just died. And I love the fact that Stephen Hawking isn't exactly sure what happened before the Big Bang. And that, you know, you're left to kind of contemplate this much bigger question that no matter where I look, no one can answer. And there's something nice about questions that, you know, no one really can answer. It sort of requires each other. It requires us to sort of be with each other and talk to each other. And, you know, my son and I know who won the UMBC UVA game. We don't know whether life is a box of chocolates or it's all planned out.
Yeah, I that's like a conversational practice, right? Like, I'm 50 now. I don't want to be around anyone who knows anything. I'm so drawn to the people who are like, I don't know. And I love when that moment happens in conversation where you can tell that the person was kind of winding up to say something. Like, they had the words in their mouth. They had the sentence worked out in their mind. And they were just waiting for you to finish. And then something you say makes the sentence like dissolve in their mouth, and then they're thinking in a new way, like where you've actually affected the way someone thinks and what they're going to say next. Because I think like 90% of the time you're going to say what you're going to say, and I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and we don't have much of a shot of impacting one another's thinking. But in Grey Fox Lane, you could see that where people would say something and another person, there would be pockets of silence in which people were actually rethinking something rather than just taking turns talking. And that's such a super satisfying part of the Neighborhood Project writ large. And also that particular conversation was sort of loaded with thoughtfulness rather than power talking.
Yeah, you know, I spoke with Mark Shriver this morning and we were just talking about sort of plans. And Mark Shriver is someone who spoke at the Nantucket Project in the fall. And he's a, you know, he's a notable Democrat. I mean, that's what he is. If you were to say that who's Mark Shriver? Well, he's Sergeant Shriver's son. Someone's going to say, oh, he's a Kennedy, so he's a Democrat. Well, he is, I guess. I guess he's a Democrat. His wife is a Republican and he loves his wife. And I hope I'm not breaking any confidences. We'll edit this out if he says not to talk about it. But there's something so sweet and beautiful about the fact that they are blissfully in love and politically oppositional or different, let's say. And there's something nice about that. There's something nice about a willingness and a not only a willingness, but seeming some kind of celebration of the fact that we are these different kinds of people. I hope I can do that. I'm sure most of the time I'm like most people and I just act like an idiot, think I know everything. But then every now and again, I wake up and realize I'm acting like the idiot who thinks he knows everything.
You know, it's funny about Mark Shriver is I was just with Maria Shriver and learned, I did not know this, that she changed her party affiliation. She is not a Democrat. She re-registered as an independent. And she said she typically votes Democrat, but that she really, it started to seem to her almost crazy that anybody was registered as a Democrat or Republican, and that everybody really, if they were being true to themselves, would be independent, and it would be their choices would rely less on the candidate's party and more about, you know, the combination of their positions on various issues that mattered to any given voter. And it was so funny the way she said it. I thought, like, right. Of course, like that, we are better off when we're open like that, and when we're in a receptive state rather than in a projecting state.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, people are gonna love listening to Gordon and Luli. They are every bit as charming as after you watch the Illumination, you want them to be. And she's hilarious, and she had so many funny jokes with me off stage about how sometimes the only power she has over Gordon. She was telling me the story about how Gordon swims. He's an open water swimmer and she has to stand on the shore and it's terrifying for her to watch the current take him because he has no idea where he's going, but he always comes back in and she's screaming and yelling and he doesn't listen to her. And he, of course, he skis and all sorts of things that she would have tried to make him stop doing. But she's the only control she has is she gets to pick out what he wears. And so we were saying, I was saying, oh, you should put like a naked lady tie on him or something if he doesn't behave. So they're a pretty awesome couple.
You know, in the film is the song Both Sides Now.
I know. And it's so good.
Well, and you just ask yourself that question, like, to what extent have I looked at life from both sides now? Mm-hmm. You know, and it goes back to what we were saying a moment ago. That is, to me, among the most powerful things about the lives that they've lived is that they've truly had to sort of look at these sides in a variety of ways. And while there are certainly there are downsides to not having that choice, there are a ton of upsides. Like there are so many gifts to understanding what you come to understand through lack of comfort. You know, and I think so often we focus on our comfort and our contentment. And I'm not saying those are bad things, but I am saying that, you know, experiencing life from both sides, and there's probably more than two sides, is a real gift. And when people sort of walk us into that, there's something really nice about that.
Yeah. I mean, he talks right off the bat, you're about to hear it, about his mother dying when he was young. And going from a house of, you know, a really cohesive family, six kids, you know, safety, security, to being kind of undone. And then he went off to boarding school at 11. And I think that was his first real experience with, you know, deep, deep challenge. And I think the more we experience, the better we get at it and the more capable we become.
Well, it's a great interview, and I think you're all going to enjoy it.
Bye, guys. Luli and Gordon Gund have been together for 50 years, 47 of which Gordon has been blind. I'd seen a film about them last fall at the Nantucket Project called The Illumination, and I couldn't wait to talk to them. Their partnership is as charming as it is effective. They exude stamina and have this determined confidence that makes them especially effective advocates to fight for anything, including blindness. I started by asking Gordon about his childhood. He grew up in a prominent family in Cleveland. I was wondering if that's where his hardiness came from.
Well, I was very interested in hearing you talk with Chris. He did a great job, I think, and very interesting story. Mine, I lived in a family of, well, I had five siblings, so six of us all together, and it was chaotic. It was wonderful, but my mother got quite ill fairly early in our life, so I was sent away to school at 11 years old, which was pretty young to go to a boarding school. And that, I, in thinking about your question about where resilience comes from, I think sometimes it comes from an experience like that, where you have to dig pretty deep and go, get along and do things. And I wasn't that good a student when I got to the school, so the other students were far better and better trained, knew how to study. I don't think it was my teacher's fault. It was my fault, probably, for not having learned how to study well and how to focus.
So I would tag that as a trait of resilient people, is that you just took very casually personal responsibility for something. And I believe you could divide the world between people think it's their fault and people who think it might be my own fault. And you just said that it wasn't the teacher's fault. And I think that matters. It's like a worldview almost.
Interesting. And so I found myself way behind, both academically and in a way physically too, and just in terms of how I thought about myself. And so I think that required me to really dig deep, try and find ways to, and hard work was a big part of it, how to get back into the game.
Did your mom die?
She did, yeah.
Before you went to school?
No, right afterward, 1.5 years afterwards, so.
Your father, how'd your father do?
It was difficult, but did a great job, I think, and each of us was at a different point in our lives. I mean, I was 13 when she died. The youngest in the group was 9, my younger sister. So for each one, it was a different experience.
And then you got to school, and how'd that go?
Well, it started out with some difficulty because I was way behind and needed to do a lot of remedial work. And fortunately,
And were you up for that? Like, is that the kind of person you are? Like, are you a
sure.
digger?
Yeah. Yeah. Another thing that in your talk with Chris just came through again to me is, I think, competitiveness, and I think he has that, and I had that. I guess you don't live in a family of six and not have a little bit of competitiveness developed.
Don't you think there's a huge advantage to being from a big family?
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with certainly.
I mean, I just think it defines expectations. It's like you're just going to have to figure out so much stuff by yourself because there's just so much less hand-holding.
You gotta learn about diplomacy and about alliances.
How did you guys meet? Because I think that one of the most interesting features of your story is that you both have to participate at a really high level to make the life that you have made. And it's extraordinary life. Extraordinary. Probably more extraordinary than it ever would have been had your sight stayed.
Well, I have no doubt about that. The way she's dealt with something that didn't happen to her. We met early on and we're at that time dating other people and so.
How scandalous. I didn't know that.
right.
I love it.
It's funny.
Let's say their names. Who were they? Who were you dating?
No.
They might be listening.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah,
to increase your traffic.
That's right.
His roommate married a roommate of mine, and so we were asked to be godparents for their youngest son. I was thrilled. I said, oh my gosh, what a compliment. This is fantastic. And she said, you know, do you remember Gordon Gund? Because he's the godfather, and he said he'd be happy to drive you up when I said you work in New York. So that's how we really met on our way. I mean, you know, driving from New York to Boston takes a while. And he really.
And by the time you got to Boston?
By the time we got to Boston, I was also really snowed because we had a flat tire. He was driving at the time, you could see. And Gordon, I swear, maybe it was in my memory, he fixed it with a licorice stick. You know those long, what do you call them, the long licorice things?
Yeah.
And he got us to a filling station. And I thought, oh my God.
So he's like MacGyver.
Oh, right, exactly. Gordon
you
MacGyver.
You married MacGyver.
I did.
And Lily was such a babe.
Yes, well, you got that right.
Yeah. I mean, like, crazy. Cutest girl I've ever seen. Like. Right.
And then we were also, then we had to be godparents at the church over the...
Did you already have a crush at that point?
No, I thought he was, you know, pretty terrific. But the overwhelming thing was he was so nice. I mean, now, of course, I can tell you he's not nice at all. No, you're wonderful. But at the baptismal font, I had a pen on. And the baby started to cry, and I put the baby, like in the movies, because I'm the youngest, I never babysat, up like this, and went pat, pat, pat. And the baby's blood was trickling down the cheek. And Gordon comes over and said, can I help you? Being one of six kids. So that's the beginning.
You mean you pierced the baby with your pin at the baptism? This story is so much better than I could have imagined. Like, starting with the Twizzler to, like, stabbing the baby. No wonder you fell in love. If your vision had not gone, what was your life going to look like?
You know, that's a good question. I started a venture capital company. I went to work first for the Chase Manhattan Bank, was a lending officer for them until 1968, and then decided that what I really liked doing was not lending money to companies that could probably lend the bank money. So I went into the venture capital business and joined with somebody else who had a lot of experience with it, because it took that. And so it was a very early time for venture capital in 1968.
Probably a really formative thing too, actually, to see things grow out of nothing and to see people try something that other people think is crazy and have it kind of work out and watch people iterate and struggle and climb mountains, like, makes you a little more, it's almost like exposure therapy. I mean, it just makes you a little more comfortable with risk yourself and a little more comfortable with uncertainty.
Absolutely, and I think you learn in that case what resilience means too, because nothing works out the way it's supposed to. When you've got a young business that's not very well capitalized and you get up one day and it's raining and that could destroy the business or something like that.
Yes.
You know, it's any number of things that can happen. That it's so fragile.
And that's like an expectation setting moment too. Like, I finally understand that the way to go into everything is to assume that it is not going to go as you planned it. And to the extent that you're comfortable with that and that you're ready for that is the extent to which you will succeed.
There's a concept called constructive imagining. So to think about any way it could go wrong and think about how am I going to deal with it? This is before it happened. So how am I going to work with things that could go wrong or the ways that things might unfold? Think about it from lots of different vantage points. It's amazing how much it can help.
It's also very soothing. Like, I used to have panic attacks, and I went to see a therapist about them, and she said one of the things that you could do is just play it out.
Yes.
Instead of pushing all your energy toward blocking the feeling, just roll with it. The lump is a tumor. Yes, the tumor means you need to do chemotherapy. Yes, chemotherapy means you're going to lose your hair. Yes, your children might have it. Like, keep going and keep figuring out how you might solve each little successive problem.
Said very well. That's exactly the kind of thought I had.
So from 26, where you go see the first person, to the last thing you saw before your vision went, how many years was that?
The night vision part went over a longer period of time, so for the first 3 years. Then in 1970, my day vision went in 6 months, so it went very quickly. For me, my eyesight started from the periphery at night to close in, till I had to give up driving at night. I had to give up anything of that kind of nature that might involve safety for other people.
And do you have children at this point?
One that was born in 68, our other son was born in 1970, and it was during that time, just before that, that my day vision went very quickly. And so, you know, you can read sentences at a time, then words, then letters, then, you know, then you can't.
So Luli, was there ever a point where you were like, boy, maybe I shouldn't get pregnant?
We really didn't know that he would go blind completely. Certainly, we didn't know when we had Grant. And even when we had Zach, that was when he did go blind. Right. Well, we thought maybe about having a third child, and there I did think, no, hey, by then we knew that it could be genetic, and we knew that the boys, we'd had them tested, our sons, and that they didn't have it. And I thought,
get out of the casino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's time to quit this game.
And one of the very last things you saw was your second son.
Yes. And it was when I had, it's like looking through a straw. Imagine trying to do that. You have to scan. But I was in the delivery room when he was born, and I got to see him in the next couple of days. And then that straw closed in.
So what does your son look like to you in your mind's eye?
What I see, besides a lot of colors, which I love, but it's ideas of people. They both look a lot like Luli, which I can remember pretty well, and then like me, I guess. And so I have some sense, but I don't, it's not
but
a...
But it doesn't matter.
No.
Because it's the idea of them that
that's
matters.
That's right.
That's amazing. I mean, in some ways, that's really a gift. I mean, that is how we would all like to be seen. Per our earlier conversation with Chris, and like all the pain that comes from the body you're born in, and I have these two teenage daughters, and my boobs are too big, or I'm too tall, or my feet are size 12, or my teeth are too big. All this agony that comes with the container we walk around in, the people in your life, the people you love, are just totally freed from that. It's such a distraction what people look like, I guess, is what I'm saying. You know, it's very distracting.
You're
talking to a good-looking guy, I act funny. I wish I didn't know he was good-looking.
It's also very deceptive, and that's what you're saying. I think you can get by a lot of stereotypes, a lot of prejudices, a lot of things that don't matter, but that do to people who allow them to. I don't even have to decide. That's not important. Mm-hmm.
So, like Chris, you had this thing happen to you, and your life changed, and then you decided to dive into it. And you created this foundation for fighting blindness, and you've actually cured people.
I don't know how much of resilience is persistence, but I can tell you there's a lot of that that went into the foundation.
I think the relationship between resilience and persistence is that the resilient person is less easily discouraged.
Yes. So in 1970, when my sight, when I lost it, we just put a man on the moon. We didn't understand this, but thought, well, it's going to be easy. We'll start an organization. We joined some other people. The foundation really grew to become the center of our lives in a lot of ways because we met a lot more people whose circumstances weren't as fortunate as ours. But we began to think this is really a way to take something that was difficult for us, but is even more difficult for other people, and make something out of it.
And Luli, there was a moment where it was like, we're going to have to decide here if we're going to wallow or if we're going to go for it.
Because we realized there wasn't a cure. And there hadn't been much research. And I do think when you get in that kind of a situation, the only way to really survive it, you become the aggressor. It's not going to beat you up. You're going to beat it up. So uh-huh. And if you're working on something to find the answer, it's not suddenly as traumatic. It did help to know that we were working on it.
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny. I've had breast cancer. And I always tell people when they call, you're going to feel so much better once you get diagnosed and you start chemotherapy, because it's a completely different thing to be looking into like the specter of possibility and not really being able to see the outlines to like putting chemo dates on a calendar. Then it's a marathon.
An example from my point of view, the same idea. With a degenerative problem that's progressive, that you're losing certain amounts of whatever the senses or whatever the part of your body is, that every day was different. I didn't know how much sight I'd have. I also didn't know where it was going to go. So I was almost wishing near the end for it to be over so I could start again.
Wow.
I must say I could understand it, because I think waking up every day thinking, is it better or is it worse? Is it better or is it worse?
Yes.
It's just a nightmare.
But you fear the unknown. I mean, like you were saying, once you can start a program to deal with it, and hopefully successfully as you did, then you can get on with other aspects of your life and with that part of your
life.
Yes.
And we worked with so many other families. Back then, they would say, please, please keep this secret, because if my boss finds out, I'll lose my job.
Oh, God.
And we sent out all our literature in the beginning in unmarked envelopes.
Or if my spouse finds out.
Yeah.
In some cases, don't send,
that happened a lot.
Don't send any of the material to my home, because I don't want my husband to see it or my wife to see it.
Because they're afraid.
They'll leave.
Yeah. Not you guys. Not the best love story in America. That was not going to happen here. Did you ever feel suicidal?
No, I didn't. And a big reason is that I really am lucky to have, to have a wonderful wife, to have these two sons, and then a lot of friends and a lot of family, and things that I really wanted to do and cared about. So I never felt that way. I know Lily makes fun about, well, if you don't want to keep going, you don't have to. I guess I never felt like that. I just felt I got to
find a way. Did you ever feel like, Luli, if you want to go be with someone else, go ahead?
Oh, well, that would never happen.
No. Who's going to leave you, baby?
Right, precious. We're lucky we just ran into each other and it clicked. So
yeah.
And also, the losing your sight doesn't change who you are.
Yes, it's funny that there must have been a moment, as all people I think who are hit with crisis do, where there's a bit of an accounting, and you try to find yourself in the hierarchy of pain and suffering, and you start to realize, like, oh, sight, no problem. Like, what if I lost my mind?
Yeah.
Or what if I was in a wheelchair? Yeah. Or, you know, you start to, or just being unhappy.
Lots of people say, well, it's a loss, and when it's like any other loss, if you lose a loved one or somebody else, you'll begin to adapt and get over it. You never do get over it. I mean, it's always there. So it's a living loss, not an ending loss.
And you wake up to it every morning.
It's just part of life.
Yeah.
I would never want to end it, nor do I regret that it happened, because I think there have been huge amounts of positive things that have come out of it, too. So,
do you think that your love affair is better and bigger and more intimate for this?
Sure, I think it made me very, very different in terms of my relationship relating to you. And in order to try not to have it be a dependency, which I think is very important to avoid, we've worked, both of us, very hard at that. So that to the extent that I can be independent and can do things that are helpful to her, I want to do those.
I do think if one person doesn't see, you have to talk it out. You know, you can't just shrug or...
Yes, right. You can't roll your eyes.
No.
Well, so, you can, but nobody's going to catch you.
Hey, our kids tried that. Our sons tried that growing up all the time. They couldn't understand when they give me a dirty look, one kind of look or other, and I wasn't reading it. I wasn't...
Right.
So you have to learn to talk and describe what your case is.
Also, you have to touch a lot.
Yeah.
Which I have noticed being around you. At first, I was like, oh, God, I love how they're always, like, snuggled up together. And I thought, oh, it's just because he can't see, so he's got to hold her hand. But then when you sit down, you're still touching. Yeah. And I think, oh, they're like a unit. I mean, you're like you're a very special unit. That's all.
Thank you.
Well,
you really are.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you're not, you know, with us 24/7.
Yeah. Have I romanticized it? I mean, have I built it up in my mind? You guys, like, shut the door and you're like, I'll tell you what, you cut me off one more time and we get interviewed.
That's right. That's it. Anyway.
Or you could, you know, but you could play such great tricks on them. I mean, you could put them in an ugly tie, right, you know.
Do you
know there are naked ladies on your tie right now?
No, but that's one of the fights we have, because he generally is very casual and everything. So I'll say to him something like, well, this evening I think you really should wear a tie or this. And I said to him, Gordon, you know, if you look awful, people don't blame you for it. They think, why does she let that blind man go out looking like that?
So there are people in the world who think things happen for a reason. Are you people like that? Did the lights go out for a reason?
I would say so. I mean, everybody has experiences that are watershed changing experiences for them, and I think they do happen for a reason. Is that previously ordained? I don't know. I don't think so. But I think you try and take whatever does come your way and turn it into something that works.
Do you think it happened for a reason?
Well, I've wondered if, because Gordon does have just an untold amount of persistence and resilience, as you say. So I wonder if it landed on him because they knew that he would get on it and move it. Because he's, if you really want him to do something, just tell him he can't.
That is a hallmark of a resilient person.
Yeah.
Is that they, that is their trigger moment.
Yeah.
Which is, you are double not going to solve this. Yeah, double dare. The only thing that we're ever going to have a problem with, you and me, Gordon Gund, is that I'm a Warriors fan.
Well, I thought when you introduced me as the person who brought LeBron James to Cleveland, I wanted to say, I'm sorry, you guys, I hope you go down a second time.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, I just was feeling so close to you, you know? Like, I was definitely going to hug you after this.
Don't let anything stop that.
Yeah. What haven't you been able to do that you really wanted to do? Was there things as a young man that you imagined?
Well, I think since I've lost my sight, the thing I want to do is see this foundation successful. When we set it up, this was with other people 46, almost 47 years ago, we thought we could get the job done pretty quickly. Of course, we haven't.
I think that is a feature of resilient people. I think they're slightly delusional. And I think the delusion is very, very helpful.
That's interesting, because some have thought, and I've occasionally thought, we have, about, well, what if we had known how long it would take?
Would we
have done it? I still think we would have.
So now there's a kid in Brussels.
Right.
Named Yannick, who very quickly went blind as a toddler.
He was blind practically from birth.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was one of the first to receive that therapy, and for him it restored significant amounts of sight. The trial was only done in one eye, with the other eye being the so-called control.
How cruel.
As soon as it became clear it was working, the people who had been in the trial earlier on were treated in their other eye right away.
And how old was he when you met him?
About 15, I think, the first time I met him. I went to Philadelphia to meet him.
And what does that mother say to you when you walk through that door having restored her son's sight?
All of a sudden, the thing you've worked for, 42 years on, here's somebody who was blind who's walking in, high. And he was like, whew. It was incredible. Yeah.
It's incredible. That's a legacy. Yeah.
Well,
that's a legacy.
Now they're more than, thank you. So we went into business to go out of business, and I can't wait. I hope you and I get to experience that.
And everybody's very kind saying that we did it. But this was done with so many other people pushing the ox cart. I mean, these research scientists and doctors who spend their lives staring into a test tube in a lab, and that's their whole life.
I once had a debate with my dad, because we both had cancer at the same time. And he thinks prayer saved him, and I think chemotherapy saved me. And he said, oh, Lovey, what do you think people want to spend their whole life developing chemotherapy for? Like, if you don't think that's God, do you believe in God?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
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 I
did you always?
Yes. I mean, I've certainly always believed in a supreme being and a God. I'm not big on the dogma.
I think if you just take that a step further, you think about how people work together, the power of that is... Well, that's God, for sure. Lully said if we can be proud of anything, we can be proud of the fact that we help bring people together. World-class people.
Are you an optimist?
Sure.
Always? Yeah. Born an optimist?
As long as I can remember, yeah.
Are you more optimistic now than you were when you were 20?
Yes.
I adore you both, and I feel so lucky to have gotten to know you. And
well, thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
This podcast and the Neighborhood Project are powered by the Nantucket Project.